Hello, everyone. My name is David Greenwalt with Leanness Lifestyle University. Today, I have a very special guest on the phone. I'm super excited to be interviewing her. She is Dr. Krista Casaza from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Welcome to the interview, Dr. Casaza.
Thank you. I'm very honored to have this opportunity.
The reason that I asked Dr. Casaza to do this interview, and I'm so glad that she was willing to do it, is because she's published a number of papers. And one paper that I saw in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2013 had to do with the myths and presumptions and facts about obesity. And I remember I read that paper, I just devoured it, and I just was smiling ear to ear, and almost, I as I told Dr. Casaza, she could probably hear me, cheering, from Alabama all the way, with me being in Illinois. And recently, there was another paper that she published in Critical Reviews in Food Science and Nutrition titled Weighing the Evidence of Common Beliefs in Obesity Research. And after I read that one, I said, oh, my gosh, I've got to see if I can get Dr. Casaza to do an interview with me and talk about some of these things. So, Dr. Casaza, would you give us a little background on your education experience and areas of greatest interest currently?
Okay, so I'm from Florida. I'm from South Florida. Initially, I did all of my early education at the University of Florida, that being my bachelor's and master's. And then I went and back to South Florida, where I'm from, and I taught high school for 6 years, and I realized that's really not the place for me. So I got my PhD in Miami at the Florida International University in Miami. And when I graduated with my PhD, I also got my registered dietitian credentials. And I started working as a sports nutritionist at FIU and wanted to really try to get a broader experience in terms of metabolism, genetics, and physiology. And I was offered a postdoc at University of Alabama in 2006. And so I came here as a postdoc. And I've been here ever since, and I'm currently assistant professor in Department of Nutrition Sciences. And my primary, so through my PhD and most of my work in terms of sports nutrition and wellness has been really focused on the pediatric population, and pediatric meaning really below the age of 21, but all of my current studies are truly pediatric population, looking at early pubertal kids and combating, preventing, or trying to reverse the obesity phenotype prior to puberty, because it gets much more difficult as reproductive maturity ensues. And so the majority of my participants in my research studies are ages 7 to 11, 7 to 12, somewhere around there.
Interesting. So how did you... What drew you to dietetics? What drew you to, you got your PhD, but also your RDs. What drew you to that?
I got my master's in physiology. I always had an exercise and physiology interest. And then my roommate in college became anorexic. She was overweight, obese, and then she became anorexic. And just trying to understand the whole comprehensive view of overweight and then anorexic and just the changes in metabolism, the physiology, particularly in the muscles and the quality of muscle, losing control of her foot initially because she just didn't have the right physiological response with the lack of calories, whereas prior to when she was overweight and obese, the aspect of in terms of coordination, and it was just really interesting to me that the physiology of just ordinary movement was driven so much by consumption. I thought, this is what I want to do. And then when I went to, I still kind of put it off for a little while. Then when I went to teach in high school, and I really saw, for the first time, to me that there was such an epidemic among the pediatric population, in high school kids, 200-300 pound kids, which to me I hadn't seen when I was in school. There was a couple overweight kids, but not, I just saw it unfolding in front of me, and I thought, this is where I need to be. And so that's when I went and got my PhD and just went from there and just continued to draw interest in trying to understand the multiple pathways to disease progression and how we could potentially prevent those early on.
So interesting. And, you know, one of the things that stood out to me, because I didn't know this about you, is that your focus is on pediatrics and primarily with kids under the age of 21. But with the two studies that, you know, I'm referencing and what really drew me to you, those two studies aren't related to, you know, really the pediatric as much, or are they? And if either way, whatever your answer may be, what kind of drew you to that type of research, you know, where we're looking at breaking through the myths and presumptions, you know, of weight loss and, you know, obesity treatment that is primarily, you know, going to be in the age sector of those in their, you know, 30s and up. I don't mean to say that, just as you said, that childhood obesity isn't a huge issue. I mean, obviously it is, you know, tripling the rate since X period of time and all of that. But you know, the adult population is struggling so much with it as well. So what drew you to, you know, the type of research that drew me to you?
Well, you know, that's probably the most common question when anyone asks about these two works in general, because I'm pretty much known as a pediatric obesity researcher. But it really came about because of some interactions with the other co-authors in, you know, in passing or just in normal conversation. And we really wanted to kind of interrogate some of these things that we commonly hear. And in terms of the pediatric population, you know, a lot of these myths and these propagated beliefs are oftentimes, as you said, in adulthood and kind of used as a way out, why I continue to weight cycle or why I continue to, you know, not be able to lose weight based on these preconceived beliefs or what have you. And so in terms of me, why I particularly got a very intense interest and really wanted to do this project is because, first of all, if we can kind of put those myths out there for the adults, because that's really where it's mostly propagated, but then to demonstrate and to really take that back to its roots in terms of the pediatric population so that, you know, we don't get to that point where it just seems like it's a vicious cycle of continuous, you know, weight cycling or continuous weight gain, you know, these different things or successes and failures based on what we have these ideas that are oftentimes not even backed by science. So it's kind of a whole cumulative umbrella of everything that I have done throughout my career from the pediatric and adult population, but really circling it back around to really touch the most people at once.
That makes perfect sense. And what strikes me, and I may say this wrong, is that, you know, unlike some of the economics in our country that are, you know, set up to be trickled down and supposedly are going to have an effect, in this way, I think you'll agree, but I'm not sure. I definitely don't want to put words in your mouth. But by addressing the misconceptions, presumptions, and myths with the adults, the adults are the models for the children. And if the adults are teaching the children more factual ways and thoughts and information, then it kind of trickles down to the kids, and you're starting with like the root of it, which is the parents that lead and the children model after them. Do I have that even remotely close?
I have that absolutely correct. And, you know, just in terms of beyond the modeling, then, you know, these beliefs that we hold so dear and so true are oftentimes because we continuously hear them over time. And if we can start with the adult population and kind of dispel these myths, not only are they models, but maybe they could assist in, you know, participating in giving the information correctly or dispelling the myths to their the people that they're the kids that they're modeling and so forth.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. All right, let's get to this stuff, because as a wellness coach, I am dealing every day with misconceptions, presumptions, and myths and so forth. So let's talk about some terms that you bring out in your papers, and I'll have you explain what they are. So there really are a fair number of presumptions and myths about the best methods for losing weight. And a lot of people may not know the difference between the two, presumption and myth. Mm-hmm. Now, you distinguish them importantly and clearly in your most recent paper anyway. So what's the difference between a presumption and a myth, and why does it matter?
So we use the term myth to refer to beliefs that are held true despite the existence of fairly substantial scientific-based evidence that they're not true. So the randomized control trial, or you know, some of the gold standards for doing the definitive study or capturing the best available evidence is counter to what the myth, to what the belief is. That we call that a myth, whereas a presumption, it's beliefs that are held true, but the convincing evidence doesn't yet exist to give us definitive answer one way or the other. So it appears that there is some not strong support for it, or there is strong, but there's the evidence doesn't yet exist in a definitive manner to call it a myth.
Okay. So just so I'll try to summarize each thing as we kind of go along, just for my listener and my student. So if I'm understanding you correctly, a presumption is something where the evidence isn't really there strongly to either support or refute the idea or the thing that is being, that is believed or is being, you know, reset over and over and over again. The evidence isn't there to strongly support or refute it. And but for a myth, whatever is being said is continuing to be said, whether it be in the media or by adults or educators or wherever, textbooks or anywhere else, and it continues to be said, but there is evidence that actually directly refutes it.
Correct.
Okay. All right. That's awesome. All right. So now we're not going to be able to cover all the myths and presumptions that you covered in your research, but if you don't mind, I'd like to focus on some specific areas I think will be of greatest interest to my students, and have you state whether what I'm about to say is a fact, a myth, or a presumption.
Okay.
So are you ready? Here we go. Number one, if you lose weight quickly, you're more likely to gain it all back than if you lose weight slowly. Fact, myth, presumption?
That is a myth.
It's a myth. Okay, so how would you summarize the research then, since it's a myth and there's research that actually refutes it? How would you best summarize, you know, the research that, you know, refutes that myth?
Right. So for the most part, that belief came about with the very beginning, studies with very low calorie diets. And so put on a very low-calorie diet, like 500-600 calories for a person that was had been consuming well over 2,000, you know, a normal amount of calories or an excessive amount of calories, cutting their calories to 500-600 calories, very low-calorie, even 400, just wasn't sustainable with the ketosis, you know, the ketone production and the dehydration and so forth. And so that's the ability to sustain a very low calorie diet kind of got a misconstrued as that that you were going to gain the weight back quickly. So what occurred was with dehydration, there was a rapid weight loss initially, which was mainly water weight, which was then rebounded. When we look at that on paper, yes, that makes sense. You drop, you know, as opposed to 1 to 2 pounds per week, as compared to like 5 to 10 pounds, you know, I'm just making up numbers now, and in a very short term. So in the very short term, that rapid weight loss in terms of water weight and then a rebound because it couldn't be sustained, that is kind of how what the heart of that myth was. But the long-term studies have completely refuted that. In fact, the people that lose weight more rapidly, so now we're getting out of just the 1 to 2 week period where there's that adjustment phase, but a rapid weight loss, and the people that lose weight more quickly over about 3 months or, you know, a significant amount of time actually tend to lose more weight over time because they are really kind of have that buy-in there that I can lose weight. So it's a whole, it's beyond just the physiology, but it becomes a psychology as well. I personally, I'm just, you know, I just, this is completely personal, but if I am several hundred pounds overweight and I'm told to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week and I need to lose 200 pounds, I find that very difficult to be able to stay motivated to continue to lose just a small amount of weight. And I think that a lot of the psychological aspects of the what we call rapid weight loss is tied into that, as what I'm talking about as far as I'm concerned, because you get that success, that feeling of success when you're actually losing weight. And so that is kind of where each of those sections are written by the experts in the field for that particular myth. And we all had contribution, but the meat of it was written by experts in the field. And the Arne Astrup in Europe wrote that. So he has done the randomized controlled trials in which he has put adults, obese women and men, on low-calorie diets and had rapid weight loss as opposed to the gradual weight loss. And not only do the adults that have more rapid weight loss lose more weight over time, but those that do gain weight back, there's no difference in the ones that gain weight over 1 to 2 years than if they lose weight more slowly. So, you know, that's the evidence that exists. The best evidence is a randomized control trial, matched side by side, BMI, adiposity, and doing the definitive study. And there's absolutely no difference, or those that lose weight more rapidly actually are better off in the long term.
That's one of the things, one of the first things I read in both of your papers, you know, that stated, you know, that information. That's where I was like, yes, you know, working in the field for 20 years as a wellness coach, working with people who have been fighting overweight and obesity, and, you know, working with students who are, you know, 300, 400 plus pounds, but always hearing throughout my education, you know, that it's 1 to 2 pounds, 1 to 2 pounds, 1 to 2 pounds. And I tell you what, I did not find in the trenches, you know, in the real world, that telling someone who was 250, 300, 350, 400 or more pounds, they absolutely must adhere to 1 to 2 pounds a week. I didn't find that to be motivating or a success plan at all. And so that's one of the reasons I cheered, of course, when I saw your work, because in the trenches, for people that are, you know, of a heavier weight, they do often lose, you know, more than that, you know, standard 1 to 2 pounds. And one of the things I wanted to ask, and I'll say too, it makes perfect sense in the trenches as well, working with people that are overweight every day, that it is more motivating.
Mm-hmm.
It is more motivating when you've got a little bit faster weight loss on the front side. It's encouraging, and because it is work, you know, it's work to make these lifestyle changes on nutrition and exercise and mindset.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, do you like a percent, you know, if 1 to 2 pounds is not necessarily the end-all be-all for all people on a weekly basis, is there a percent of body weight that you like? Is there a range, and is there something where in your professional experience and that you would say, I would not recommend, you know, someone try to lose more than X per week? Is, if 1 to 2 is not the gospel, what would you say is, you know, and I realize it's different for each person, but where was the safe zone, or what's the smart zone?
Yeah, well, see, that's exactly, you got it right. It's different for every person, and so I wouldn't recommend any particular number. There is so many things that go into that in terms of the way that weight is lost. So people say, I want to lose weight, but what they're really saying is, I want to lose fat. And there's no way to just lose fat. So, I mean, if you completely starve yourself and don't, you know, engage in any musculoskeletal contractions, whether, you know, just activities of daily living or resistance training, which I would really recommend, you know, you're going to lose a lot more muscle and bone mass and along with that fat. So you could, in, you know, 5% to one person that's sedentary and just, you know, starving themselves, for lack of a better word, as opposed to 5 to 10% for somebody that is engaging in resistance training and more of the lifestyle approach to even a rapid weight loss, is two completely different things. So my recommendation is to, I'm an athlete, so my recommendation is to push yourself as hard as you can push yourself and still be able to function at a high level. And so if you are not taking care of your body enough to be able to, you know, go for a jog, or, you know, you're so fatigued because you're not engaging in behaviors that are supporting the nourishment of your body as well as the nourishment of, you know, your psyche, then, you know, it's completely counterproductive. It doesn't really matter how much you're losing if you're losing that weight in a way that is not promoting a healthier lifestyle.
Yeah, that's just fantastic information. I appreciate your perspective on that, for sure. It's just such a relief to have, you know, the facts and research evidence-based data to kind of set aside the idea that the end-all be-all is 1 to 2 pounds a week, and that you must lose it slowly, because if you don't, you're going to regain it all back. And if I'm hearing you correctly, I think we would probably both agree that for a certain sector of people, losing it slowly and taking the small change philosophy might be best. But there's another sector that were not being as considered before, or they were being judged for being more aggressive and losing the weight quicker. But if I'm hearing you correctly, based on the research, it kind of seems like those that are able and willing, and where it fits their life and mindset, to work harder, put out a little bit more, be a little tighter and smarter with their nutrition, and in doing so, their weight loss is rapid weight loss. It seems like they get really, you know, pretty much all of the benefits with no more negative than the people who lose it slowly.
I completely agree, and I think that I would even be willing to say that they get all the benefits and probably a little bit more than somebody that's going to lose it more slowly. Because let's face it, most people gain back the weight. And if you're losing more weight, they gain back some of the weight. So if you lose more weight in a shorter amount of time, even over a year, if you've gained back 10 pounds, but you started out losing 40 initially, then you're better off than if you've only lost 20 pounds over a long period of time. You know, mathematically speaking, as well as just the whole health aspects, I think I would even be arguably tempted to say that the person that loses it more rapid gets all the benefits and maybe a little bit more than somebody that loses it more slowly.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for that perspective. All right, let's go to the next thing here, because I'll tell you what, I deal with this next one every day, especially with our site being one where our online campus is one where we do ask our students to record certain behaviors and things. So here it is. So is this a fact, presumption, or myth? Don't weigh yourself more than about once a week, or you're going to get frustrated and quit. Or definitely don't weigh yourself daily. That's obsessive.
We have the daily self-weighing as a myth, even among some of the authors. We tried to determine if we were going to put that in the myth or presumption. It was agreed that it was in fact a myth, only because there have been some studies that have shown that in terms of motivation. So the ones with direct outcomes being weight loss, completely a myth. In terms of some of the quality of life measures, the depression and that thing, some of the more psychological based studies have shown that there may be some difference in psychological outcomes. However, we determined it was a myth because this paper is focused on obesity research. Now, it may be similar with the trans-theoretical model and some of the stages of readiness, that kind of thing. In other realms or disciplines, there may be some evidence that makes it non-mythical in terms of but in terms of obesity research, in terms of the outcome being weight change, weight loss, weight gain, is it in fact a myth? Daily self-weighing does not appear in any of the randomized controlled trials to interfere with, to halt, to have any impact on weight management.
And I think if I read it correctly, and I may not have, one of the things that jumped out at me in most recent paper was there was, you know, when you were looking at some of the randomized controlled trials where they looked at, not only did they look at people who weighed, we'll call it frequently or daily, but they were looking at that being the only thing they had asked their participants to change in their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking at weight loss, if I understand it correctly, and the only thing they wanted them to do, the only thing they asked them to do, was to record their weight and review it once or twice a day. And if I understand what you wrote in the paper, they found that not only did weighing, you know, daily and reviewing it daily or multiple times a day, just reviewing it, not weighing obsessively 10 times a day, but weighing daily and then reviewing it a couple times a day, not only did it not hurt weight loss, but it actually helped weight loss.
Absolutely.
Is that true?
Absolutely. And that's what I'm saying in terms of weight outcomes. It was actually beneficial in terms of weight outcomes to weigh yourself daily, not several times a day, but daily.
Right.
And so this you know, I wanted to just kind of backtrack a little bit. So the studies that show that it will interfere with weight loss in terms of psychology do not use weight as an outcome. They only use the psychological variables. And so the ones that actually look at weight as an outcome, exactly as you stated, it's more beneficial, very similar to the way that we look at food diaries. When you start to write down everything that you eat, the more that you write down, the more that you actually can review what you've eaten, those people are more successful in being able to identify their food patterns and are more likely to have a more successful change in intake. Because of the reviewing that and just the daily reviewing that and the daily reminder. So those people were, in fact, in the randomized control trials, had better outcomes in terms of weight loss.
Yeah, that's, you know, and in the real world, boots on the ground, working with clients every day, I absolutely find that to be true and helpful. And, you know, at Leanest Lifestyle University, we ask our students to record their dietary intake for a period of a few weeks, and it's something that, you know, we believe that we do it as a part of the education. We do it for a while. We don't necessarily do it forever. We certainly, as an education-based institution, do not demand that our students do it forever. But some students actually find that once they do it for a little while, sometimes they feel better and more in control if they do it. And even if they don't, a lot of times they'll come back to it if they feel like they're going a little bit off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But one of the things I wanted to mention on the daily weighing on the psych is just kind of what I see in the trenches, because I get what you're saying, that I think there are some either neutral or potentially, at least in the short term, negative connotations or negative effects on the psych when people are reviewing their weight on a daily basis. And what I found is, again, just kind of, you know, working it every day here in the trenches, I find that early on, if students in, have never, you know, or they've been really avoiding the scale. Some of them don't even own a scale because they didn't want to get on it. They did not want to face it. And I totally understand that. So when they first get on it and they start looking at it every day and they aren't losing 2 pounds a day, you know, that isn't happening. There is very commonly some negative an adjustment period, I'll call it, where it certainly isn't, you know, a jovial experience to step on the scale and say, you know, I'm 315 pounds. And then the next day I'm 314.3 pounds or whatever. It's still, you know, someone who's quite heavy and isn't where they want to be, and that doesn't feel good. But what I have found is when they do it daily, and just as you said with a dietary record, but when they weigh daily, what I find is it too is a educational tool, and we find that when people understand the fluctuations, when they understand the water weight fluctuations, and they understand why the scale popped up 2 pounds on a given day, or why it's dropping, and they eventually feel more in control. And where it did start off as kind of a negative and kind of a downer to see that weight every day and have it not dropping 2 pounds a day, it eventually becomes very empowering because they understand why it's doing what it's doing, and they also understand, and it helps them correct more quickly if it starts going the wrong way, and that's empowering because they can start to turn the course, or, you know, turn the corner, so to speak, and make behavior changes to correct things before it gets too out of hand. So I definitely could see it early on, especially the negative influence on the psyche. But over time, what I find is it's generally more positive.
Absolutely.
Good. All right. Awesome. All right. So here we go. Next, kind of a different category here. But, and I'll tell you, I said this, I got to be honest, you know, I've said this for a long time. And I've had to kind of back off since, you know, research like yours has come out. But here goes. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Breakfast is the most important meal of the day is a presumption.
Okay. And it's a presumption because, again, kind of going back to the definition, there isn't super strong evidence to refute or support it. Is that right?
That is correct, although the majority of the contemporary evidence suggests that eating versus skipping breakfast is by no means a way to control weight loss. In fact, a small group of authors from this paper just published in AJCN, a randomized control trial that we're doing here at UAB that pretty much suggests that it is not a method of controlling weight. And the basis of that study, we did a couple of studies that are reported in there, and I say we just being, I'm not on the paper, but just our group. The first one was just to look at the calorie intake over the day in breakfast skippers versus breakfast eaters, because that's often the there's a couple things with breakfast being the most important meal of the day. As its name implies, we break the fast and so jumpstart the metabolism. That's kind of the belief behind that. And so we first just looked at the daily calorie intake in skippers versus eaters. And those that skip breakfast, on average, eat a couple hundred, 200 to 300 calories more at lunch. However, those that eat breakfast, while they have that deficit at lunch, a deficit relative to the skippers, 200 to 300 calories they have less, they tend to consume 500 to 600 calories at breakfast. So if you compare just in calories, the people that eat breakfast actually consume more calories over the day. So just in the numbers approach, there was over the day, and then, you know, dinner is hit or miss in terms of there's not really a compensation at dinner or lack thereof. So overall, there was no statistically different difference in calorie consumption over the day in skippers versus eaters. So that really doesn't matter, because what we really want to know in terms of obesity research is what does that translate in terms of weight outcomes. And there was no difference in weight outcomes either. So there's no difference in weight. So we then did a randomized control trial in which we told the people, we had a similar arm, breakfast consumers versus breakfast skippers. And then we also had another group in which we did a crossover design, and people that ate breakfast, we told them to start skipping breakfast, and people that skipped breakfast, we told them to start eating breakfast, to see the four different conditions, you know. And so, again, there was no difference in the typical eaters versus the typical skippers. But we actually got a difference in a weight in the people that switched, whether they switched from eating to not eating or not eating to eating. The change in metabolism, they lost weight, at least in the short term. So when we go to presumption, so it's, you know, we have these different metabolic pathways, and just kind of a shock to the system in the short term may initiate some sort of weight loss or a compensatory metabolic change. We do not have long-term evidence in it, but the long-term evidence that does exist, if you look at over time, skippers versus eaters, in terms of looking at the overall evidence accumulated up to date, there does not appear to be any definitive study that demonstrates that people that eat breakfast have better weight outcomes than people that skip breakfast. But we still don't have the definitive study, which is the only reason that we put it in presumption. We honestly, as a group, believe that it is leaning towards myth, but the evidence is not there yet with the definitive. And so we're trying to do that definitive research and trying to lead the way in terms lead the charge in terms of moving it towards myth. Really, in terms of weight management as a wellness coach, to me, we really try to advise people to eat when they're hungry. And so if you're not hungry, I don't know why you would insist that somebody eat. Just like at lunchtime, at noon, we're not going to say you need to eat lunch. I mean, I know it's different in terms of breaking the fast, but we store a certain amount of glycogen in the liver. And when that is completely used up, then we'll be hungry. And so to tell the body that it's hungry just because the sun comes up or you wake up, on a personal basis, I don't think that's the right message to send. So I'm kind of pleased that we're trying to really establish that it's not, in fact, a way to control weight and to reestablish, you know, listening to the body's cues and eating when you're hungry.
So fascinating, and so just so cool to hear, you know, the actual research on the subject. And, you know, I continue to evolve. I continue to learn. I continue to learn from, you know, amazing researchers, you know, like yourself, and evidence-based publications and other resources. And, you know, Leanest Lifestyle has continued to evolve, and I have to continue to evolve and tweak, you know, what I'm teaching my students. And obviously, this is an area that I'm going to have to tweak. You can't ignore the evidence. And as we say, you know, it's Leanest Lifestyle is evidence-based lifestyle education for permanent weight control. Well, this is about as evidence-based as it gets, and I just really, really appreciate it, even though, you know, I've been teaching not a mandate, you know, that people eat breakfast, but I have certainly been recommending it, no doubt about it.
But, you know, so, in that context, you know, we go on in terms of the standard physiology from the evolutionary context. I'm really into the evolutionary development and change in metabolism. Not necessarily as we evolve as people, rather as the environment evolves. And so when we wake up and we have to engage in physical activity, whether, you know, it be actual exercise or just the things that historically were involved with waking up, you know, doing things other than sitting down to breakfast and then getting in your car to sit down for 10 more hours at work, that was a completely different metabolic paradigm than the metabolism that we are in the contemporary society. So, you know, as you said, we kind of have to, as the environment is dynamic and becomes less on the expenditure side, we kind of have to look at some of the aspects of intake, whether or not it be calories per se, but just when the body starts to need those calories for carrying out physiologic processes, your body will tell you when you're hungry. And if you completely negate those cues just because it's what we've always done, then I think the body doesn't respond as we would expect. And I think that's what we're showing with switching those contexts with the skippers versus eaters, that, you know, we need to look at it in a whole environmental approach and, you know, let the body guide that rather than just social cues guide that.
It's, again, you know, so interesting. It, you know, I'll just say, ask as an aside, and maybe this is has nothing to do with anything. Has any of the recent research on, you know, the big phrase, you know, the thing that's out there big and bold right now is intermittent fasting. Has any of that research played any role in looking at, you know, the aspect of how many meals a day someone should have and whether they should have breakfast? Is there any interplay there at all with that research, or is this just like its own, you know, the breakfast research is kind of its own little island and there's no influence on this intermittent fasting thing?
Yeah, we really haven't. A lot of the intermittent fasting, they're doing that in California, but they haven't really produced any definitive results from that as well. And so, no, I can't really speak to that. We're just really focused on the breakfast aspect.
Got it. Thank you so much. Let me ask this next one. Here we go. So fact, presumption, or myth. Eating close to bedtime or, as it is so often, anytime after 6 p.m. or anytime after 7 p.m. or those kinds of things, it will definitely cause obesity to increase.
We have that as a presumption, and the main reason for that is, for one, because the truly probative test has not been done, but for one of the reasons is because it's so variable in terms of, so eating after 6 is, you know, a lot of that research is based on, you know, the night eating is based on night shift workers, and that's really night shift workers in general have a more unhealthy metabolic phenotype just because of the circadian clock and the way that we are diurnal organisms. But in terms of being able to control the different variables there, so when we talk about eating after 6, so if you eat after 6 and you go to bed at 8, or you eat after 6, you don't eat after 6 and you go to bed at 8, it's a completely different metabolic milieu than if you don't eat after 6 and you stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, so it's very difficult to do that probe, not that it couldn't be done, but to do that study in which it is a unique interval between the last time you eat and when you go to bed. Because if you're awake, even if you're just sitting, you're burning more calories than if you're sleeping. So the reason we have it in presumption is that it's a difficult yet possible study to do. But for the most, for the research that has been collected, there's no evidence that suggests that people that eat later gain more weight or have a more difficult time losing weight. Now, on the flip side, there is accumulating evidence that people who sleep less have a more difficult time to lose weight, but not the time in which they eat. It's the amount of time they sleep. So it's kind of, again, one of these things that you have a little bit of information and you think that you can just extrapolate that to any context, and it's not the case. Whether you eat after 6 and don't eat anymore and stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning and gain or don't gain weight, it's or the amount of sleep that you get, you know, there's a lot of factors involved in there. And sleep seems to be involved in weight loss and weight management, but not the time interval between meal and sleep.
That's It's such a powerful message, and it's one that we teach, you know, heavily at within my organization with regard to sleep. Because I will say to any student, you can get your nutrition dialed in as super tight. You can have your, if you do any dietary supplements, you can have those tight. You can have your exercise exactly where it's supposed to be. But if your sleep is off, you're going to throw off everything, and you're not going to, I'm not saying you can't lose weight, but you're going to throw off everything, and it's going to look screwy.
Right.
You know, the results are not going to match the what we have on paper for output and input. We got a super clean nutrition. We got an excellent output. And the sleep is terrible, and the weight loss stinks.
Absolutely.
And we see that all the time. And then they get one or two good nights of sleep, and bam, get on the scale, and 3 pounds are gone.
Right.
You know, that correction is really cool. But it's ideally, you won't have to have a correction. But then again, I don't know anybody that doesn't every now and then, you know, and you know, not get the ideal sleep.
Right.
What are your thoughts on this, you know, if it doesn't matter what time we eat, except, you know, for shift workers that have screwed up circadian rhythms anyway, what about some of the recent research that is kind of at least causing me to scratch my head with regard to, people that ate more calories at lunch compared to people who ate, you know, more calories before lunch? There was a difference, even though the calories in a 24-hour period were essentially the same, but there was a difference. If I understand that research appropriately, there was a difference in outcome on weight, even though the calories were the same. And there, some of the researchers are starting to talk about, you know, the circadian rhythm of our meals, or the circadian rhythm of the nutrition that we consume and when we consume it. Is there anything to that, or what's your current feeling on that?
Well, I think it is a lot. I think that what we're starting to see is more the consumption of calories or the excess calories with sitting and just being in a non-moving type of environment. So, you know, those studies oftentimes are done with people that are working and eat a large lunch, and they're sitting before lunch, they eat a large lunch, and they're sitting after. So sitting has much more detrimental effects on metabolism. And even, you know, getting up and standing, we're doing a study now, just we have kids come in and they sit all day, and then we do their insulin sensitivity, or we have them stand all day. And within 24 hours, we get a difference in the whole metabolic milieu, just in these are in kids, in a day of standing versus a day of sitting. So I think a lot of that research is intertwined with the fact that the big lunch and the whole sitting thing. And I think that, again, we'd see a difference if we looked at multifacets of that and the engagement of the musculoskeletal system.
Yeah, that's so incredible. I've seen some of the research on sitting, and I'll tell you, when, you know, first time I saw that a couple of years back or whatever, I was like, well, that's interesting, you know, on the fact that we just need to move more. One way or another, we've got to get out of our chairs.
Absolutely.
All right, one more.
All right.
So, because I get this with my students all the time, because most of my students, because I'm typically best with the hard cases. So I get a lot of students that have yo-yoed, and they have fought weight for definitely more than 10 years usually, and oftentimes more than 20 years. And so I want to have you address this and see fact, myth, or presumption. If you've yo-yoed a bunch of times in your past, your metabolism is broken and you're screwed.
I believe we have that under presumption, and that's only because we included both the animal research and the human research. And I've just sent you via email, we wrote it's in under revision right now. We wrote a weight cycling review paper for Obesity Reviews. And the animal data, which that is a lot of the, that has driven a lot, is only in terms of longevity. And it seems that when you weight cycle in rodents, they live, their lifespan is decreased slightly. All the human data to date suggest the opposite, that people that actually lose weight, there is either no difference or they are metabolically more healthy. They're less likely to have diabetes. And so it's very difficult. The other thing that has driven that research is the difference between intentionality and non-intentional weight loss. So people that lose weight because non-intentionally because they have a disease state, of course, they are more likely to have morbid conditions and mortality. When we look at just people that are trying to lose weight, there's no difference in morbidity or mortality in terms of the weight cycling, the capacity to lose weight. There's no difference in people that have weight cycle versus those have the first time they tried to lose weight. And metabolically, it appears that there may be some sort of advantage because the body can respond to the attempted weight loss to a greater capacity if you've lost weight before, as opposed to if you continue to gain weight throughout your whole life, so that you have the met that challenge previously. And it's just like anything else. If you think about it in terms of other challenges that we go through in life, each time it gets a little bit easier, and you know that you can achieve it. So, and the body is able to adapt more readily. If you think about it with the immune response or any of those responses that the body is physiologically set up for, if it's something that's never been accomplished or never been interacted with in the body, that first time may be more difficult than subsequent times. But the research does not indicate any difference in weight outcomes and cyclers versus non-cyclers. So, if it takes you 10 times to actually get to where you want to go, then, 10 times is fine if you can do it in the first time. But to be discouraged because you haven't done something in the past would be counter to any argument that we have in terms of, applying for a job or, any aspect of life in which there's challenges. Why would weight loss be any different?
Wow, that's such an encouraging message. I love it so much. What I take from what you said, which is just so powerful, is, for one, it's better to try, mm-hmm. even if it does take you multiple times. And what a great analogy when you say, if you're applying for a job or you're trying to, no matter what you're trying to do, if it's anywhere remotely within reason, if you're, if you're 6'10", you're probably not going to be a ballerina. But, if it's anywhere remotely within reason at all, a lot of times we've got to, pursue the worthy endeavor, as I say, and persist without exception. You've got to keep going.
Absolutely.
You got to keep coming back at it. And from what I've seen, I've been doing this a long time, and I always feel bad when anybody regains any weight, but I know that there's a percentage that are going to. But what I have found over the years is I have found that those who do try and they do get some weight off, if they do recycle back and regain some of the weight, over the long haul, they appear to be better off than those who never tried at all, because the research supports this as well, from what I can tell, and that people that have never really given it a real go, they just continue to gain weight.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
If someone knocks it down 50 pounds but gains back 35, and then they hang out there for a while, and then they they do it again and knock that 35 off, and then eventually regain it, worst case scenario is they end up still less than what they were. But if the person never tries at all, they just keep going up and up and up and up.
You got it.
And if I'm understanding what you're saying too on the metabolism aspect, it's kind of like we're smarter for the experience.
Yes.
Each time we do it, we get better because we have more experience. We understand what's coming. It's like, okay, I know I've got to do this. I know this is going to happen. I know I'm going to feel this way. I know I've got to move this way. I know this. These foods seem to work better for me because they worked better for me the last time I did this. And one last thing, if I'm not running off the rails here, is it sounded like from what you said that people that have, done this up and down and up and down, the cyclers, as you call them, if anything, metabolism, because that's a biggie that I hear from my students. My metabolism, I know my metabolism's broken because I've yo-yoed my whole life. And from what you're saying, if I'm understanding you correctly, is not only is metabolism not broken, it's either neutral or positive from that experience.
Correct.
Yeah, that's so encouraging. So encouraging. Everybody listening, you hear this? You hear what Dr. Casaza is saying? She knows. You don't even have to take it from me. That's so awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview with me. I just want to, you know, if there's just a, you know, one or two, you know, things briefly, a couple of sentences, where to from here? What's most exciting? What's cutting edge? What's most exciting to you right now in obesity research that may potentially lead to overall reductions of overweight and obesity?
So the main focus of my research and interest is in the pediatric population. We've had limited success in terms of, particularly in Alabama, in getting these kids to lose weight. But what we're trying now is a slightly different approach, and we really seem to be getting good results. And instead of focusing on this vilification of adipose tissue, rather we're engaging the musculoskeletal system. So the muscle is the greatest utilizer of glucose in terms of utilization and storage. So we're doing resistance training in these obese little boys and girls, and we are getting improvements in metabolism and insulin sensitivity, which in the long run will affect the way that they're storing their and partitioning their nutrients. So what we're really, really pushing for is more of the engagement of the musculoskeletal system and improving musculoskeletal function, and then giving that capacity, as we talked about several times, to move more even in the obese state, which we think will have feed-forward effects on the loss of adipose tissue and the maintenance of musculoskeletal health, in which we believe that the main determinant of long-term health is the preservation and optimization of the musculoskeletal system early in development. And I think that the same thing is true when we're trying to lose weight, and I touched on that briefly. If we're on a diet and a lifestyle approach to be able to lose fat, we say we want to lose weight, but we're talking about losing fat, and we engage the musculoskeletal system and enhance our insulin sensitivity and the utilization of lipids, fats, and all of those things with the engagement of the musculoskeletal system, I believe that fat loss becomes a lot easier, and just carrying out typical metabolic processes are in a feed-forward mode and will promote the weight loss that we talk about in terms of fat loss while improving the metabolic milieu, and just the whole synergistic approach of capitalizing on the beneficial effects of muscle and bone, as opposed to just saying how bad the aspects of fat are. So that's where we are now.
I hope you'll take this the right way, but let me see here. I've got a really brilliant registered dietitian who's got her PhD, and she believes heavily in resistance training. I just have one question. Will you be a coach for us?
Anytime.
Oh my God.
Fly me up there. I'll coach.
Well, that fits so well into, you know, the model and the paradigm that we teach at Leanest Lifestyle University, because one of the things I say that does differentiate us from many of the other commercial, you know, weight loss programs that are out there is we actually do put a strong focus on resistance training. And to hear you say that that's like one of the exciting primary focuses, in that not only do we want to maintain skeletal muscle, but where possible, we want to increase skeletal muscle to a certain degree to improve insulin sensitivity and increase metabolism and on and on and on. Oh, my gosh, that is so powerful. I'm unbelievable. Thank you so much for sharing that.
No problem.
Well, Dr. Casaza, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to do this interview with us. This will be heard by thousands of people in a podcast of sorts and through MP3 download and so forth. Thank you so much for continuing to do the work that you're doing. It's absolutely incredible and important, and I just want you to know that we down here in the trenches, at least some of us anyway, do read it, and we do appreciate it because we really do our basis really is evidence-based, and just thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Hopefully we'll stay in touch.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. This is David Greenwald of Leanness Lifestyle University. For more information on programs we offer, visit leannesslifestyle.com. That's L-E-A-N-N-E-S-S lifestyle.com. I look forward to working with you personally and through the wonder of an inside-out transformation, helping you to not only turn your body, but your life around.